Welcome to Navigating Consciousness. I'm Rupert Sheldrake, and this is a podcast of my talks and conversations. If you enjoy listening, please subscribe and leave a review in your favorite podcatcher. It really helps.
Well, I'm sure we have many questions here and comments on this wonderful presentation, for which I thank you so much, Rupert. I would not like to take up too much time to give you a chance to say something, but I would like to make one comment and then ask one question. And I think that both the comment and the question goes sort of to the center of what you presented, although there are so many other things that one could deal with. And the comment concerns the soul. And it was very beautiful how you presented Aristotle's four causes for everything there is, and where the soul fits in, namely the former cause. The former cause is what makes a thing what it is. And so our soul is what makes me, me. That's my soul. Now, what I would comment on is that we have made a great mistake, and we should watch out against not sliding into this groove and making this mistake of reifying the soul, making a thing out of the soul. Because the only thing that is a thing in Aristotle's four aspects of something is the material cause. It's what it is. That's what it is. So nobody would make out of the efficient cause something. The chiseling, okay, the chiseling is an action, but you are not thinking that the chiseling, after it's over, goes somewhere or weighs something or something like that. It's a cause. It's a completely different thing. Nor the final cause. The statue is commissioned by the city authorities. Well, that's fine. We understand what it is, but you're not making something out of it. The something is the material of the statue. You're not making out of the commission something that has a weight and goes somewhere. And exactly in the same way, we must not make out of the soul something that is now here and then goes somewhere. And we have always very often slid into this mistake. On medieval pictures, you see the soul coming out as a little homunculus that comes out and then goes to heaven. No matter how often we say, no, we don't believe this, we slide into this group. So if we take it very seriously, what you said, it helps us to remember it's not something, but it is that principle which makes a thing itself. And our soul is that what makes me, me. Now we have to say a lot more about it, and I plan to say a lot more about it, but just want to get away. The only thing that is something is the material. So that was the comment on the soul, but I will expand a little more on the soul this afternoon probably. And the question is very simple. You so clearly presented the machine and over against the organism, and the organism has this principle within itself. In other words, it has a soul. What do you think of robots and their future? Robots, because there are many people for whom this becomes then a blurred line, and all these films that are there, dozens of films about robots that have a soul and begin to feel and become human in the end.
Yes.
So it's very much in the air. So what do you have to say about robots?
Well, I think it's a mythic fantasy, basically, and its historical roots come partly from the golem, you know, the idea of turning a living head in Prague. Partly from the story of Frankenstein, which was Mary Shelley, 1818, the wife of the poet Shelley, had this idea. It's really, that was a kind of secularization of the Faust myth. And so I see them as mythic, you see, rather than real. I'll come back to one more in a moment, but The the first myth is this story in the 16th century in Germany of this magician who sells his soul to the devil in order to acquire knowledge and power. Then, even in Goethe's Faust, where the story is transformed, the moral is changed, there's still a kind of supernatural framework. But Mary, because he's carried off to heaven in the end, a kind of Baroque Germanic heaven.
eternal feminine God.
Yes. So, but Mary Shelley got rid of all this supernatural apparatus and the deus ex machina, or dea ex machina of the eternal feminine. She made Frankenstein creates a human being from body parts and electricity, and the monster comes to life, starts as a noble savage, then gets disenchanted, and then wants to destroy his maker. And so that becomes the myth of the human creation that destroys the humans that have made it. And that really is the underlying myth of modern science. Mm. Modern science achieves all these enormous powers, and yet our own creations threaten to destroy us. And this fantasy is played out in endless science fiction of robots that come to life and take over, machines that take over, and also in the environmental disaster scenarios that we're going to be destroyed and rendered extinct through our own technologies, climate change, and so forth, nuclear weapons, all the rest of it. So I see it's hard to disentangle the fact from the fantasy of robots. The assumption that you could make machinery come to life, that a computer could actually become conscious, has, I think, always been a fantasy. And the reason it's been a fantasy is two reasons. One is this human power fantasy, the Frankenstein fantasy. The other is that mechanists who believe that human beings are nothing but machines, the only way they can prove, we're obviously different from machines, so the only way they can actually prove it is by making machines that are like human beings, in other words, that are conscious and come to life. So the idea is we can prove that humans are nothing but machines when we've made machines that are like human beings. So there's a huge amount of fantasy and wishful thinking built into this. Well, no, there's one thing I'd say, though, that if we're going to have a machine that does come to life, I mean, if these fantasies are realizable at all, it would only be if we could have a machine that was inherently indeterminate, that had a kind of organizing field, a kind of morphic field within it. It would have to be an analog computer with genuine randomness within it. And I think such machines might actually be possible, but they're not going to be digital computers. They're going to be analog computers with a lot of randomness within them. And such a thing might be possible, but if it did, it would have its own morphic field, its own memory. It would be a completely new kind of machine. It would be a kind of organic machine. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be digital engineering. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just conceivable.
I see. So that really answers the question, because I was going to play the devil's advocate and say, what if we have not yet achieved it, but we might eventually achieve it. And you say, yeah, we might eventually achieve something that is really living, but not by the means that we are using now, the digital computers, but a different kind of computer.
Yes, by using a kind of organic metaphor rather than a mechanistic one.
Right.
And you see, one of the points about the materialist theory is that none of these dogmas are actually supported by evidence. But what materialists always say is, well, we can't yet prove it, but give us another 20 years, 50 years, and we will prove it. And this is what the philosopher Sir Karl Popper called promissory materialism.
Yeah.
It involves issuing promissory notes against future explanations. And so we can't yet prove that living organisms are nothing but machines, but give us another 20 years of progress in molecular biology and molecular genetics, and we will do. And they're usually undated promissory notes. When I took up Lewis Wolpert, one of my sparring partners in England, in the Genome Wager in 2009, we were having a debate on the nature of life at the Cambridge University Science Festival. It was the last event in the Science Festival capacity audience. And he said, it won't be long before, given the human genome and the fertilized egg, we can predict every detail of the ensuing person, including abnormalities, and modify it at will. So I said, okay, Lewis, I'll bet you a bottle of champagne that that's not going to happen. I said, let's bet it won't happen within 20 years. And he said, well, maybe not 20. And I said, well, 50. He said, well, maybe not 50. I said, well, how long then? He said, well, maybe 100. And I said, well, that's a meaningless bet, you know, we in our direction. So I followed it up with him afterwards, and I said, okay, let's make this a real bet. It can't be humans. We'll have a real stake. We agreed on the stake. That was the easy bet. It's a case of vintage port. It's Quinta de Vesuvio 2005, which the experts say we'll be drinking perfectly by 2029. And we bought half the case each. It's in a vault. So it actually physically exists, this case of port. Getting better with every year. And the wager is, he then said, oh, well, it can't be a human within 20 years. It has to be a mouse. So I said, all right, within 20 years, the wager is, within 20 years, given the genome of a mouse, we can predict every detail of the ensuing organism. Then he said, agreed. And a week later, he emailed me, he said, Rupert, I've been thinking about it. Okay, mouse is a bit too complicated. It has to be a chick. So I said, all right, a mouse or a chick. And then after a week, he said, well, you know, even a chick's a bit too complicated. It's going to have to be a frog. So I said, right, a mouse, a chick, or a frog. And then after another week, he emailed me again. He said, I've been talking to a few people in the field. Even a frog would be a bit. It's going to have to be a worm. A nematode worm. So I said, all right, a mouse, chick, frog, or nematode worm. And then he emailed me again after that, and he said, gather, there's a bit of problem in understanding protein folding. So once you've made the proteins, there's a problem predicting the exact structure of them. I said, yes, Lewis, there's thousands of proteins even in a worm, and for your wager to come true, they'd have to predict the folding of all the proteins. They can't predict the folding of a single protein at the moment. He said, well, I think we should leave proteins out. And I said, so I said, well, that defeats the entire purpose. I said, a 10-year-old can tell you that frog spawn is going to turn into a frog. You don't need advanced molecular biology. I said, this has to be an a priori prediction. So anyway, I got him to agree in the end, by May the 1st, 2029, given the fertilized egg, the genome of a fertilized egg of any organism, we'll be able to predict all its details. And so we published this in New Scientist. It was widely discussed on the internet. The Royal Society will adjudicate if the issue is not obvious. But most biologists have, once you focus the issue like that, the vast majority are betting that I'll win the bet. And even Walter, when I saw him a few months ago at the Royal Society, he came up to me at this party and said, Rupert, he said, I've been thinking about it. He said, I'm afraid you're going to win our bet.
did you get the bottle of champagne?
Not yet. No, we still got to wait until
2029. On this level, it's fun. But when you think of those promissory notes with regard to nuclear energy and nuclear waste disposal, it becomes suicidal and not fun anymore.
Yes.
And that is why it is so important.
That's right. And the whole thing is based on promissory notes. So you see how I came to this debate with Walcott. I said, the trouble with you, Lois, it's very difficult to debate with you because you're such a man of faith. I'm not a man of faith, I'm an atheist. And I said, yes, but you have total faith in the explanatory system, this belief system, your materialist belief system. It's a total act of faith. Not one element of it's been proved. And yet you believe it will be proved that science will turn your beliefs into facts at some indeterminate time in the future. And I said, that's an act of faith. Faith is a belief. It's the substance of things hoped for, I said, according to the Epistle to the Hebrews. I mean, it's a perfect definition of faith, that it will come true. And he was very, very reluctant to see that actually the materialist worldview is a faith system. It's a faith position.
It's faith very much along the same lines as religious faith, rightly understood, namely courageous trust, ultimate trust, but it is limited because it lacks the second element, hope, which is openness for surprise. And that must be total openness for surprise, and it doesn't allow that maybe this isn't going to work, you see? So
yes.
It's a limited faith. And a religious faith, rightly understood, is a wider faith. Yeah. But we'll pick that up when we talk about spirituality. And now it's your turn.
Yeah.
I guess this is more of a statement than a question. But personally, what I see behind all of this is, like, you know, if the science is, like, really looking for truth, and what I see in a lot of science is that there is highly dogmatic, and there's political controls about where they can go and what they can bring up. But if they're sincerely looking for truth, and spirituality is looking for that truth, they're going to meet up at the same place. I mean, you can't be anything but, as long as they are following some form of truth.
Yes. Well, I think that's true if people are sincerely looking for truth, but the fact is we're all bound by dogmas and implicit beliefs, and a lot of scientists think they already know the truth, you see. They think this materialist belief system is the truth. The confidence of militant atheists like Richard Dawkins comes from the fact they think they know the truth, mm-hmm. and that everybody else who doesn't agree with it doesn't know the truth, and they need to be enlightened through the public understanding of science. So he's a kind of proselytizing atheist. And in his book, The God Delusion, he just takes for granted the whole of this belief system, because he thinks it's true. So I've had arguments with him and other convinced materialists, and what they don't realize is that their beliefs are just beliefs, that they're just assumptions. They assume the mind is in the brain, for example. They don't think that's an assumption. They think that's a fact. So the problem with anyone seeking the truth is that it's very hard for them to be aware of what beliefs they have, which you can't question all beliefs all the time, and none of us have enough time or energy to do that. And I myself, although I question many of the beliefs and dogmas of science, as I said, it was only a year ago I began to question the conservation of matter and energy, because that was so deeply embedded in my belief system. I'd worked around it and I thought that it treated as an inviolate truth. And when I began to question it, it fell apart quite rapidly. But that is the problem, that we're never necessarily aware of what our beliefs are, our fixed beliefs, because we think they're true. And so seeking the truth involves a questioning process that may go beyond anything that we've envisaged.
Yeah, definitely. I think openness is really the meat of the matter. And something that I heard years ago that I really like is, truth is like a flower, is growing. What may be the truth today,
yes,
may not be truth tomorrow. And to be open for that truth to reveal itself, I guess.
I think that is an ideal, you see. And I think the problem with the present setup of science is that almost all scientists are institutional nowadays. In the 19th century, a lot of scientists worked independently. Mm-hmm. Charles Darwin, for example, never had an academic post or a government grant. He married a rich woman. He made a fortune speculating in railway stocks. And he lived as an independent gentleman. And he didn't have to apply for grants. And he could think what he liked. It was controversial, but he could just do it. A lot of scientists in the 19th century were like that. But now, almost everybody in the scientific world is working for a government, a university, or a corporation. All of them are working on short-term grants, two-year, three-year grants. Most scientists spend most of their time filling in grant applications, and they won't apply for anything they think they can't get a grant for. And the grants are controlled by central committees, which are usually quite conservative, and anonymous peer review, which is very conservative. So this really damps down any spirit of independence or inquiry. And for PhD students, who are the people who do most of the actual research in science, because the senior scientists are almost entirely involved with grant proposals, administration and so on, committees, the PhD students, who often are curious, are told, you know, don't stray from the beaten track, because you won't get a good PhD and you'll never get a job. And so this extends right back to the graduate students, this conformism. So, unfortunately, the way science is institutionally organized doesn't encourage independent inquiry.
How can you do it?
I've been able to do it personally, because when I published my first book, A New Science of Life, it meant I couldn't get a job again in the university. It was denounced in Nature. I was excommunicated by the editor of Nature in a front page editorial called A Book for Burning. And the result was that I couldn't, I had to work independently. And providentially, I had enough savings to start with. I have a small inherited income. My wife works. I've had people who've helped me out with grants and things. And somehow, I've had books that have sold well enough to provide an income. Living from hand to mouth, never knowing what's happening the next year, everything's worked out fine. I've been able to raise kids and so on. So, but I wouldn't recommend it to anyone else. I've been very fortunate. But it's not a career path that, I would advise a graduate student to try and follow. It's tough, and it's precarious. And the fact I got married late was a major part. I didn't get married till I was over 40, and I'd already done this work. I wouldn't have been able to do it if I'd had kids to support. So I've been fortunate, and it's very unusual. There's probably about half a dozen to a dozen independent scientists in the world at the moment. Everybody else is institutionalized.
A Book for Burning is such a significant title, right?
Yes.
Burning.
Well, he compared it unfavorably with Mein Kampf. Of course, it was very good for sales. But but it wasn't good for, applying for regular grants. Because, it was basically an excommunication.
Yeah.
And this, they quote on one of my later books, the new edition of A New Science of Life, Morphic Resonance. There's a quote from Maddox. That was in 1981. In 1994, he was interviewed for BBC television, whether he regretted this denunciation. And he's interviewed there. He is in the Nature offices with volumes of Nature behind him, the editor of Nature. As somebody said, he often confuses himself with the author of Nature. He actually, it turned out he confused himself with the Pope. Because what he then said was, when he was asked, did he regret this attack on my book? He said, no. He said, Sheldrake deserved to be condemned for the same reasons and in the same language as the Pope condemned Galileo. It's heresy. And it was this extraordinary thing, you see, that this belief that science, the fact that scientists think they have the one truth, means that unlike politics or a court of law, where in politics we're used to, the Republicans have different policies from the Democrats and they coexist. In Britain, the Conservatives and Labour have different policies. And if one of them came to power and exterminated all opposition, that would be totalitarianism. We're used to pluralism in politics. In a court of law, you hear both sides. They're given equal time. It's a fair, level playing field. But in science, it's not like that. It's inherited this ideal of the pre-Reformation Catholic Church, is what it's based on, that we know the truth, and that anyone who doesn't agree with this truth that's established at any given time is a heretic. And when Kuhn talked about the structure of scientific revolutions as scientific new paradigm replaces an old one, this wasn't the kind of revolution where an authoritarian regime is replaced by a democracy. It was more like those old-style South American revolutions where one military junta is replaced by another. A new dictatorship takes over. So it's never had a culture of pluralism. And, in religion there's a culture of pluralism, because after the Reformation, the Roman Church found, Protestant churches all over Europe. They split up into lots of others. In Judaism, there's different schools of thought, always have been, in Hinduism, in Buddhism, in Islam, there's Shias and Sunnis. So there's never been a monopoly in the realm of religion. But science is the one belief system which has a total world monopoly. It's achieved what Roman Catholic missionaries fantasized in the 16th century.
But what you do, one of the important functions of what you do is that you question the powers and make them show color, you see? That science has to embarrass itself in such a way that they say this book is for burning and excommunicated and all these things, shows what the establishment really is. Mm. So that is one of the most important functions that you have, that you show them, show the world for what this establishment is.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, it's not my chosen. I mean, it's what. I mean, I prefer to get on with the debate of changing science.
Of course.
Rather than have to press all these buttons. Yes.
Do you see any evidence, like, even under the pressure of the perceived cataclysmic nature of our problems today and stuff like that, that there's enough pressure for people to break their mold now, and amongst the younger generation, that there might be some sort of rebirth of creative thinking because it's so important to us, to the future?
I think there's plenty of people who think creatively in private. So
well,
it's not
I mean
a question.
I don't mean in private.
No,
I mean
it's a question of institutional change, you see.
Yeah.
The trouble with the academic system, the university system was established in the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
And it shares the kind of authoritarian structure that was, you know, part of the medieval way of doing things. So we have our whole academic and educational system is based on a principle of authority. You know, schools are told what to do by universities, and the exams are set, at least in Britain, by universities. Changing that is rather difficult. And the government science funding is dominated by committees of establishment scientists, bureaucrats, and corporations. That's who decides what money to spend in Canada and the US and in Britain and elsewhere. I have proposed one reform, which is in science funding, 1% of public science funding should be spent on research that actually interests the public. And ask people what they're interested in. 99% of taxpayers' money would still go to what these big committees decide. But 1%, people could suggest research that would be actually be interesting. That's an attempt to sort of drive a wedge into the system, loosen it up. And some politicians have been interested in it. I was published in Nature, New Scientist, the New York Times, Die Zeit in Germany. And I talked to a number of politicians in England about it, top ones, and they liked the idea, but nothing's actually happened. But the trouble with institutional reform is very difficult when you have established institutions. And so my attempts to reform science is partly to loosen up the funding system like that, partly to conduct some of the scientific things in the public arena, because corporations are more open than universities. If one could have a contest that shows you can make energy with some of these seemingly miraculous machines, and these could actually make a profit, then corporations would start making them, and then universities would have to, physics departments would have to figure out how they work. But the driving force would have to come, I think, from the entrepreneurial world, not from the academic world, which is highly conservative. And I think the thing that will drive change more than anything is the medical system, because the existing medical system is too expensive and getting more so, both in America with private insurance and in Europe and Canada with public healthcare systems. They're all becoming unaffordable. And mechanistic medicine is very expensive, and it gets more expensive. So one way of getting a better medical system would be to include alternative therapies, have an integrated medicine approach, more emphasis on lifestyle prevention, more emphasis on what works, you know, acupuncture, homeopathy. These are much cheaper than expensive medicine. And so if we had a system of medicine that just was based on what works, rather than doctrinally driven, we could have a cheaper and more effective medical system. And then when that happened, again, in medical schools, physiology departments, people are trying to figure out how it works. So I think medicine would be one of the main driving forces for this, at least in biology.
Could you speak more specifically about the ways that you see morphic resonance as a concept actually being a part of that creative effectiveness. You know, you mentioned homeopathy, And of course, I thought about, well, yeah, homeopathy is the natural expression of morphic resonance, you know. And are you aware that there is a theory in psychology that is positing that mind is something that exists outside of the brain, interpersonal neurobiology, that mind is the exchange of energy and information between two brains? Being developed at UCLA.
Yes.
So that is a direct application of morphic resonance within psychology. So
yes.
I do see that medical field, that healing and change is kind of a natural overlap where it would be financially expedient to approve these ideas in outcomes that could be measured.
Well, I think the key thing is outcome research. You see, I think that if medical research moved away from the double-blind placebo-controlled trial, where you compare a new pill with a placebo, to outcomes research, or what's now called comparative effectiveness research. If you took lower back pain, for example, lots of people with lower back pain, and they were randomly sent to anyone who claimed to treat it, chiropractors, acupuncturists, homeopaths, physios, physical therapists, and so forth, and you just compare all these different methods and see what works. Do they all work? Do some people get better with one more than with others? And also, which are the cheaper ones? If medicine was based on a level playing field trial of all the different therapies for different conditions, then we could have a much more pragmatic medical system. And then I think that the question of how they work would definitely arise. And one way that I think this change could be driven is if the Chinese and the Indians and other people get sufficient confidence to break loose of the colonial mentality they're still in. Last year, 2.5 million people that graduated in India with science and engineering degrees, 1.5 million in China, in the US, 500,000, in Britain, 100,000. And in Britain and the US, a third of those students were foreign, mostly Chinese and Indian. Mm-hmm. So the fact is that among young scientists today, the majority are not Western. The majority are in Asia. And the center of gravity of science will shift. And when that happens, if they have enough, they're still dominated by fear of what people would say in science and nature and people in Washington and New York and London and so forth. But as soon as they get sufficient confidence to take seriously qi and prana and yoga and acupuncture and things and start reframing physiology instead of having it in a separate Western compartment, who knows what will happen? And I think medicine will open up tremendously, and I think that the idea of morphic fields and morphic resonance could play a part in these new, in an integrated theory of medicine.
Rupert, you were talking about your experiences and conversation with a conservative cosmologist. What do you think would happen if you talked to a very progressive or a radical cosmologist?
Well, there aren't really very... Well, the thing is that there aren't any really radical ones, because cosmology itself is fairly radical at the moment. They've got... You know, the radical ones within cosmology postulate that our universe is one of billions of universes in parallel. And that's radical cosmology. Actually, that's now become mainstream. The majority are now in favour of the so-called multiverse theory. And that's radical because there's no evidence whatever for all these extra universes. And there's many people question whether it's even science at all. And within physics, the leading theoretical physics at the moment is superstring theory and M theory. Superstring theory has 10 dimensions, M theory 11. Extra dimensions come cheap in modern physics. Mm-hmm. And the trouble is neither of those is testable. And superstring theory predicts the existence of at least 10 to the 500 universes. So they've now got this wild proliferation of universes, a kind of hyperinflation of universes. And why do they want it? Well, the answer is because they believe that the laws of nature are fixed at the moment of the Big Bang. The laws and the constants are fixed. That our universe is just right for life to evolve. And it could have been totally different. They could have been, all these laws and constants could have been very different. So they say, well, that means one of two things. Either they were all fine-tuned by an intelligent designer, a kind of neo-deism, a god who designed everything just right for life and then stood back while it all unfolded. Some physicists take that view. The others say, well, there can't be any kind of god involved. So instead, if there are billions and billions of universes, we just happen to live in the one that enables human life to emerge, that has the right values and laws and constants. But there's nothing special about this. It's just one of an almost infinite number of universes, all of which actually exist. So you don't need a designer. And I said to Martin Rees, who's president of the Royal Society, Astronomer Royal, Master of Trinity College, Cambridge, an old friend of mine, who's a top cosmologist. I said to him, Martin, why do you really want this universe? I said, this vast proliferation of unobserved universes for which there's not a shred of evidence. He said, because that's the simpler hypothesis. And I said, it's not simple at all. You've got all these unobserved universes. He said, yes, but that way we can get rid of God. And so I said, well, I said, surely this is the ultimate violation of Occam's razor, the principle that you shouldn't multiply entities unnecessarily. I said, you've multiplied universes without limit to get rid of God. So is it really the simpler hypothesis? He said, well, I agree there's a bit of a problem with Occam's razor. We're working on it. that's radical cosmology today. And it's completely unconstrained, you know, because you can have all these unobserved universes based on superstring theory, which isn't testable. One of the opponents of superstring theory wrote a book called Not Even Wrong. And there's a chap called Lee Smolin, who's at the Perimeter Institute in Canada, who wrote a book called The Trouble with Physics, which sketches out these problems very clearly, if anyone's interested in looking at that. But I think radical cosmology would be considering the possibility that the stars are conscious, that galaxies have minds, that the whole universe is conscious. But I know this isn't on their agenda, because I was having lunch with Martin Rees, a private lunch, just me and him, sitting in his garden, and I said to him, Martin, have you ever considered the possibility that the sun might be conscious? He said, what? I said, the idea that the sun could be conscious, that there could be consciousness in the universe, in beings beyond the earth and in these great heavenly bodies. He said, no, I've never thought about that at all. And I said, do any of your colleagues discuss it? And he said, certainly not. And he changed the subject. It was very clear I wasn't going to get anywhere with this discussion. And he's one of the more open-minded cosmologists. So it is although they're much broader than most kinds of scientists, they still have quite severe limits when it comes to what they're prepared to think about. And one of the reasons they can't consider the sun or the universe being conscious is the dogma matter is unconscious. It's a foundational dogma of the whole belief system.
I think, what about the work of Ryan Spent? He's a cosmologist, and I think he would think the universe is conscious.
Yes, well, Brian Swim is the one counterexample. You're right. I mean, Brian Swim is somebody who's taken this universe story together with Thomas Berry, who's a great visionary, and taken a view of the whole universe as a creation story that gives meaning and so on to life on Earth. So I think it's true. Brian Swim is a radical in that sense, but I've taken his work as being more poetic than scientific, because you couldn't actually do experiments to test that. And so, no, you're right, though. I should have mentioned him, because he's somebody who is looking at it in a broader way. But you'd never hear his work being discussed by other cosmologists.
A popularizer.
Yes, he's a kind of popularizer. Yes.
A very good one.
It's a bit like Fritjof Capra's work on quantum physics. You see, he's popularized and made many people aware of the weirdness of quantum physics. He's done a fantastic job in doing that. But he's not at the forefront of experimental quantum physics. He's popularized quantum physics and broadened it out. And most people who read books on popular science want to read about these broader questions. Most people aren't very interested in the technical details of cosmology and molecular biology. It's the bigger questions that interest people. It's what used to be called natural philosophy. In fact, until about 1850 in England, the word scientist wasn't used. It was only introduced in the 1840s. Before that, they were called natural philosophers, and science was called experimental philosophy. I actually like that. I prefer the idea of science as natural philosophy, the philosophy of nature.